Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today, we are talking about a major threat to the citrus industry, the Asian citrus psyllid, and the disease that it can spread, Huanglong bean disease. The following is brought to you by the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program. For more than a decade, California's citrus industry has been fighting off its biggest threat yet, and is transmitted by a pest no larger than a grain of rice. The Asian citrus psyllid and the deadly tree disease it can carry, Huanglong bean, also known as HLB or citrus greening, is a death sentence for California citrus trees, as it has no cure, and once infected, the trees will die. The Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division at the California Department of Food and Agriculture is a statewide, dedicated workforce of professionals with a primary focus on fighting against invasive pests and diseases, including keeping HLB out of commercial groves. Through a variety of statewide activities, including surveying, treatments, regulatory activities, biocontrol releases, research, and outreach, just to name a few, division staff, in collaboration with key industry stakeholders, continues to put its best foot forward in the fight against HLB. Now, while HLB has not yet been found in a commercial grove, California growers must continue to hold strong. I have joining me today Victoria Hornbaker, director of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division at CDFA. We're going to discuss California's progress thus far and the steps growers should take to ensure that the pest and disease don't take hold of California groves. Well, first off, thanks for joining us today, Victoria. I appreciate you taking some time out to talk with me.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you guys today and get some information out there to folks before they start traveling for the holiday weekend.
Yes, of course. So let's start off with just talking about the state of Asian citrus psyllid and Huanglong bean in California and what people need to know about where we're at right now.
Okay, so we have the pest of the disease. So Asian citrus psyllid is the bug that can carry the disease, Huanglong bean or HLB, or some people may have heard of it called citrus greening. Right now we have Asian citrus psyllid in Southern California. That region is considered generally infested. And we also have HLB in Southern California. We do not have established populations of Asian citrus psyllid north of the Tehachapi, so basically north of the grapevine. But we do sometimes have sporadic incipient infestations that we call it a local eradication. We eradicate those ACP infestations. In Southern California, though, we do have HLB, the disease. It's been found in four counties. It's been found in Los Angeles, Orange, San Bernardino, and Riverside counties. And we do have a quarantine established in those parts of those counties. And what that does is it prevents citrus nursery stock or bulk fruit from moving into or out of those areas because we don't want to take the chance of moving a psyllid that may be carrying the bacteria to a new area. So there should not be any nurseries in that HLB quarantine area selling nursery stock, but of course a lot of folks have trees in their yards in that HLB quarantine area. So we really want to urge people not to move citrus fruit, any type of distance. They can share it locally with their neighbors, but we also want them to remove stems and leaves and wash the fruit. We really are concerned about that accidental or inadvertent movement of a psyllid that might be carrying the bacteria into an area like Ventura or the Central Valley where we don't have HLB.
Right. And the HLB that has been found so far has been residential, not commercial groves, correct?
That is correct. We're up to just over 2,300 trees that have been confirmed with the bacteria or with the disease HLB, and those trees have been removed so that we don't allow the bacteria to stay in the environment where other psyllids can feed on it and spread it. But you're right, only in backyard citrus trees. So far, we have not found any HLB positive trees in our commercial citrus in California.
And then let's just go right to why that is important. What could happen to our citrus industry if this did spread from residential into commercial groves?
Yeah, if this spreads to our commercial citrus industry, it could be a death sentence for citrus in California. There is no cure for the disease. The best thing that we can do is, you know, keep those Asian citrus psyllid populations low and remove trees when we find them, so remove that inoculum. The scariest thing with this bacteria is that it has a long latency period. So a tree may be infected but not expressing symptoms. So it's acting as a vector, and is acting as a source of inoculum for vectors to feed on and spread the disease. So that's why it's so important for our staff to be out there looking and taking samples of trees and looking for the bacteria. And I'm happy to say that, you know, like I said, we've successfully identified and removed over 2,300 trees in the LA Basin. Every time we take one of those trees out and we do it, we knock down the psyllid populations in that area, we're preventing that spread of the disease. If this got a foothold in our commercial citrus, we would see a decline in citrus production. We would see trees become very sick and not able to maintain the fruit once the fruit sets, so you see a lot of fruit drop. We would also see fruit that would be unpalatable, so fruit that would be very off-tasting or rancid-tasting. And for California, we are a state that produces fresh citrus fruit. We produce 80% of the fresh citrus fruit that gets sold in the United States. We would not be able to market that fruit in California or elsewhere if it was positive for HLB, because it just would not be palatable. What we've seen in Florida is a drastic reduction in their production from HLB. They are fortunate in some respects because they primarily grow juice fruit. So they are able to, you know, use the fruit that's growing on the trees, even if the trees are infected, but it requires them to do a lot of blending. So they can't just pick an orange or pick an orange tree and make juice out of the oranges. They would have to blend it with some other fruit juices or sugars or something to overcome that off-putting taste. But, the biggest issue is the trees will die. There's no cure, although we have some of the best scientists in the world working on this pest and disease complex. If it gets a hold of those trees, they will have to be removed. They will die. They will, it's going to cost our growers and our consumers a lot of money to continue to get the delicious fresh citrus fruit that comes out of California.
Right. And we're talking about orange trees, too. So if those trees die, it's not something you can just plant and have another crop next year.
Exactly. It takes anywhere from 4 to 7 years for a citrus tree to be productive once it's planted.
So how are government agencies like yours working with homeowners, but then also with people in the industry, growers? How's everybody working together to help keep this under control?
Well, I'm really proud and pleased to say that this is a very collaborative effort. At CDFA, Department of Food and Agriculture in California, we have this dedicated resource that we work just on citrus pests, but we're not doing it alone. We work with our partners at the United States Department of Agriculture. They provide financial support. They also provide scientific support. We work very closely with our colleges and universities in the state. Like I said, some of the best and brightest minds in the world are working on this, and thankfully and luckily, a lot of those are in California. We have partners at UC Riverside and UC Davis. We work with folks from Sacramento State University. We are very fortunate to have great support from great scientists. We also work with our local county ag commissioners. So every county in California has an ag commissioner, and they have staff. We partner with them. They help us enforce our regulations. They help us trap and do survey work for Asian citrus psyllid. And they support us, again, for all of the activities that we're doing. They partner with us. And like you said, we also work with the industry. We work with the growers. We work with the packing houses. We work with the marketing groups for citrus. We work with the California Citrus Research Board, again, supporting us with science and helping us really inform the activities that we're doing. I'm very proud to say that we are constantly looking for process improvement in this program. We want to be doing things better, faster, safer, you know, throwing anything that we can at it that, that might be new and innovative. But probably the biggest partner that we have in this fight against this pest and disease are the residents or the citizens of California. We are knocking on people's doors, asking them to survey their trees, hang traps in their yard, put on a suppressive treatment for Asian citrus psyllid. In those cases where we find a positive tree, pull out their tree. Granted, all of these things are being done at no cost to the homeowner, but they're welcoming us onto their property. They're cooperating with us when we're there. And again, sometimes, you know, we're asking them to allow us to take out a tree that they may really be fond of. You know, their kids may get fruit from that tree, but they're doing it for the greater good to protect other citrus trees in their neighborhood, in their community, and really to protect the citrus industry at large in California. So like I said, I'm always very proud when I talk about the collaboration that goes into this program. I've worked in the ag industry for quite some time and on many different pest and disease issues. And by far, I see the most cooperation of anything I've ever worked on in this project.
So I'm trying to remember back, and I really can't remember. It seems like it was maybe 8 or 9 years ago. When did we first start seeing the Asian citrus psyllid in California, and how was your division created? Was it created about that time, or was it already around?
So we found the first Asian citrus psyllid in California in 2008. In 2009, the California citrus growers came together and worked with the state to develop some legislation to establish a committee of growers that would give advice to the Secretary of Agriculture. And at that time, it also created a program. That program, the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program, was in charge of doing some of the activities that we're doing now. But we've added activities as we've gone along. So it's called Assembly Bill 281, and that was in 2009. Established the committee, established the program. So we've been actively working on this pest and disease since 2008, but program and committee established in 2009. In 2018, the committee came together and said, we would like to do some strategic planning. We would like to, you know, set up some goals, some priorities. So they worked through this process. And during the process, they decided that they really needed a dedicated workforce working on citrus pest and diseases in California. And the governor agreed with them. So the governor supported that initiative. And in 2019, the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division was established at CDFA. And that is, we were able to pull some staff that had been working on this during the time it was a program. So people that were very knowledgeable and experienced came over into the division. We were also able to recruit some new talent as part of establishing the division, which I'm very happy to say that, you know, we've got, when I talk about the best and the brightest of the researchers, you know, working on this project, we've got the best and the brightest staff working on this project in California. We've got people that come from different diversified backgrounds with different experiences, plus people that have been working on this pest and disease since 2008. And are extremely knowledgeable on the pest complex. So right now, we're slated to have a total of 168 dedicated staff. We're still in the process of doing some recruitment. I'm sure you can imagine COVID kind of made things a little difficult for us in 2020 with, you know, recruitments and different things. But our folks are out there working hard, doing their job, you know, ag workers, including people working on pests and diseases, were considered essential workers. So we were out there doing our job even during the COVID pandemic.
I didn't know that. I knew that most of ag was considered essential workers, but I didn't realize that people fighting the diseases as well were able to continue. So that's excellent news.
Yeah, you know, if we had stopped, and that doesn't just go for my division, it also goes for our plant division at CDFA, and they look for other invasive pests and diseases that don't impact citrus necessarily. But if we stopped looking for those pests and diseases for a whole year, you can imagine how many of those things could have potentially established in new areas and just really compounded the issue for us or for, like I said, other pests or diseases. So we had to continue to be out there working through the pandemic.
Once again, we are talking with Victoria Hornbaker, the director of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division at CDFA. Our conversation continues right after this.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
We are talking with Victoria Hornbaker, Director of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division at CDFA.
So let's talk a little bit about regulatory measures. Now, when I talk to citrus growers, you know, they're of course, are very concerned about this. This could wipe out their industry. And so there are measures that needed to be taken to help protect everything. So what are some regulatory measures that are used to prevent the spread of the psyllid and also of the disease?
Right. So we have quarantines in place for Asian citrus psyllid and for Wanglongbang. The quarantines that we have for both the pest and the disease restrict the movement of nursery stock from one area to another. They restrict the movement of bulk citrus from one area to another. But we also put in place mitigations that growers and nurserymen can do and achieve so that they can continue to move their fruit and their nursery stock and not impede commerce, right? So we have our nurseries are growing their nursery stock under screenhouses to prevent the psyllids from feeding on and potentially infecting them. We know that from working with our partners in Florida, that was one of the biggest issues for them is their nursery stock was not protected. So they were spreading the disease around the state with infected nursery stock. So we've got our nurseries under screen. Our production nurseries are under screen. We have compliance agreements with growers, packers, and haulers so that they are following the mitigations. One of the things that we implemented in 2017 was a requirement for all bulk fruit being moved to be covered, completely covered with either tarps or in an enclosed conveyance. And we saw a very drastic reduction in the artificial movement of Asian citrus psyllid into the valley and Northern California once we implemented that that requirement. So again, you know, it's the scientists working on this. They analyzed the patterns of detections. They saw that they were happening along transportation corridors, which led them to do an analysis and find that they saw psyllids moving in these bulk citrus trucks and flying off, you know, during transit. So we have the quarantines and we have additional regulations and mitigation measures that growers and nurserymen follow. And the nice thing is you know they're in this to win this, so they are always eager and excited to get on board with these new rules and regulations because it's going to protect the industry.
I'm curious, and I may be off track here, so let me know if I am, but I'm just curious about ACP and HLB hit so many other areas before California like Florida, but also in other countries like Brazil. So was there an opportunity to learn from what they did or what they didn't do so that California could really get in there and mitigate this before it became a huge problem here?
Absolutely. So in the early stages of us coming together as a program, so 2008 through like 2010, 11, they held a lot of meetings with citrus producing areas. We worked with Florida. We worked with, like you said, Brazil. We met with folks from Belize. We have had communications with folks from China and Africa, all talking about what were the mitigations, what steps did they take or didn't they take, right, to prevent the movement and establishment of this pest and disease. And when we were developing our program in California, we were able to take that information and learn from it and put together a very robust program. I'm very pleased to say that the incidence that we have of finding psyllids that are positive for the bacteria is very, very low. We have sampled and analyzed hundreds of thousands of Asian citrus psyllid samples. We've only had 313 of those samples come up positive for the bacteria. In other parts of the world and the United States, 60 to 70% of the psyllids are positive for the bacteria. And really what it points back to is the aggressive and proactive nature of our program.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant difference in numbers there.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, the people that I talk to in the industry, the growers I talk with and others in the citrus industry are very aware and, you know, want to protect their industry. But if there was something that you really wanted them to know either about the, you know, the pest or the disease or about your division, what would that be that you want to say directly to people within the industry?
The main thing that I want them to know is, you know, we're excited to continue our partnership. I'm very thankful to the growers in California for their willingness to participate. They support this program financially with an assessment on every 40-pound equivalent of citrus that goes to the packing house. So that's anywhere between $13 and $18 million a year that comes into this program that we use to conduct our activities in the residential parts of the state. But it's really the support, you know, it's the support that they give the program. It's their willingness to come to the table and have discussions and share ideas. And you know, they influence, the committee makes recommendations to the secretary. You know, so we're doing things for them and with them to protect California's citrus at large, not just commercial citrus. So my biggest thing would be, you know, a thank you to them for all their support and participation, you know, and that we started this program in 2009. We've been doing this for going on 11 years now. I'm actually going on 12 years now, and we have not seen HLB hit a commercial grove in other parts of the world and the U.S. They see, you know, that happen in about 5 years. Once they get the psyllid, in about 5 years, they have HLB spreading in their commercial citrus. So, you know, just a big thank you and kudos to them for all the proactive work that they're doing. The program without the growers would not be successful. It is, like I said, it's very much collaborative. The work we're doing in the residential areas in tandem with the work they're doing in the commercial groves is why this has been successful, right? If they weren't doing their part or we weren't doing our part, we would not be seeing the success we're seeing today. We would not see, you know, the first HLB positive tree was in 2012, and here we are at 2021 and not having found an HLB positive tree in a commercial grove. That's pretty exciting news.
For our listeners or people who tune in who are not in the industry, but, you know, they enjoy our citrus. So for the general public, what would you want them to know?
The main thing I want to say, again, it's another thank you, right? Without them, the participation of the residential citrus growers or homeowners, we wouldn't have the success either. You know, I want to urge them to continue to cooperate with ag officials, both state and county level ag officials, when we're knocking on doors and hanging traps and sampling trees. Remind them, you know, to enjoy their citrus at home or very locally with their neighbors. Remove stems and leaves and wash the fruit before they do share it. But don't move nursery stock or citrus fruit out of their area, or and don't bring things back when they're traveling within the U.S. or internationally, because they could inadvertently be bringing back something like ACP or HLB, or even worse. You know, there's other pests and diseases out there as well. You know, the main take home is, you know, just continue to help us, continue to cooperate, and we'll continue to do everything that we can to prevent, a total loss of citrus in California. I tell people all the time, I'm a native Californian. I grew up in Orange County. There were, you know, Orange Grove, the remnants of Orange Grove trees in my neighbor's backyards. We didn't have to buy citrus fruit because we were picking oranges off of the neighbor's trees, you know. And, mm-hmm. and I want to see that for kids in the future. I want to see, you know, my grandkids and their grandkids be able to enjoy fresh citrus fruit off of a tree grown in their backyard. You know, and that's really what we're in this for. We're protecting the industry, but we're also protecting the ability for every Californian to have a beautiful, thriving citrus tree in their yard if they choose to do so.
Absolutely. And I grew up in a home in the San Joaquin Valley that was about a half a mile from acres and acres of citrus trees. So the smell, if nothing else, you have to keep it around so that future generations know what that smell is like when all the trees are blooming and it's, you know, just in the air constantly. So yes, we need to keep this protected.
You cannot beat that smell, that orange blossom smell.
Thank you again to Victoria Hornbaker, Director of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division at CDFA. And once again, this interview was brought to you by the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Here's your news brief for today. Canadian tariff rate quotas and their impacts to U.S. imports to that market are at the center of the first ever dispute to come before the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement Resolution Panel. Rod Bain has more.
Shortly after taking office earlier this year, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack placed this emphasis regarding the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement.
To reinforce our goal and our belief that these agreements need to be enforced to the letter.
With particular focus on Canada, specifically on dairy, as the spite agreement within USMCA to improve U.S. dairy access to that market, concerns arose regarding Canadian compliance.
Whether it's wheat, dairy, any other commodity, we want to make sure that the agreement that opens up new market opportunities, that expands market opportunities, is actually implemented in the way it was intended.
Which led to the U.S. Trade Representative's office this week requesting a dispute settlement panel under USMCA to challenge Canada's allocation of dairy tariff rate quotas. The panel is expected to report its findings later this year. Secretary Vilsack says the USTR action helps to ensure Canada fulfills its commitments under USMCA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Department of Agriculture projects U.S. farm exports for 2021 at $164 billion, which is the highest on record. USDA announced its quarterly agricultural trade forecast this week. The results represent an increase of $28 billion, or 21%, from last fiscal year's total, and a $7 billion increase from USDA's previous 2021 forecast that was published in February. The annual export record of $152.3 billion was set in 2014. The U.S. Census Bureau recently released new data for the first 4 months of 2021 regarding trade with China. Michael Clements shares the results.
Data shows China is closing the gap towards reaching the goal of purchases in the Phase 1 trade agreement. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Veronica Nye summarizes the results.
The data recently released for April 2021 shows us that while China is behind on their imports relative to the commitment that they have for 2021, purchases are really coming on strong. We're looking right now at exports over $10 billion, achieving about 25% of the goal for 2021, which is $40
billion. Nye says China is on track to be the largest purchaser of U.S. ag products.
Last year, China had pledged to purchase $33 billion in ag products, and they didn't quite make it. They purchased $27 billion. But still, that was a record for U.S. ag exports. So looking at 2021 with a commitment of $40 billion, that's a huge increase in exports for U.S. ag products and would certainly secure China as the largest export destination for U.S. ag products once again.
Nye says reaching the lofty goals of the Phase 1 agreement is still possible.
Looking at current commodity prices and the purchase commitments for new crop commodities and how much further along in exports we are in 2021 relative to where we were in 2020, it seems China might actually make it this year. At least they stand a chance that U.S. ag exports might actually achieve this huge goal that was laid out in the Phase 1 agreement.
Learn more on the market intel page at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The Department of Agriculture will not appeal a federal district court ruling on faster line speeds in slaughterhouses. USDA told the Hagstrom Report that only the Justice Department can make a decision about the appeal. The comments came less than a day after the National Pork Producers Council urged USDA to intervene in the matter before the ruling takes effect at the end of next month. NPPC cites an analysis by an Iowa State University economist that shows the ruling will result in a 2.5% loss in pork packing plant capacity nationwide and more than $80 million in reduced income for small U.S. hog farmers. We finish up the news segment on this Friday with the Friday story for you. The CDC says millions of us will get sick this summer from mistakes made in outdoor grilling. Gary Crawford has an expert list of the three biggest goofs.
Here's a hit song from 1959. Here comes summer. Yes, summer's basically here right now. Lots of us are already beginning to do some outdoor grilling, including Meredith Carruthers, a food safety expert with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. First, though, we'll let you know that Meredith speaks with authority on the subject of outdoor grilling.
I do all of the grilling in our house. It's like, I love throwing stuff on the grill. It just adds a nice flavor to things. It's super easy to use.
But she says it's also super easy to make a lot of major grilling goofs that could end up causing you or your guests to get sick. Meredith, for the sake of time, how many of these goofs will we cover today?
The three biggest goofs.
Three biggest goofs, right.
Hey, what happened? Wake up and go to sleep.
I'm a victim of circumstance.
No, not those three goofs, but rather three common goofs that we make when grilling. The biggest one, Meredith?
I would say the biggest would be not fully cooking. the foods on the grill.
Ah, not using a food thermometer to get the meat and poultry up to a high enough temperature in the center to kill any bacteria in there. Next biggest goof.
Using the same utensil that you use to put all the raw stuff on the grill to take the cooked stuff off.
Ooh, or using the same platter on which you took the raw meat and poultry out to the grill to bring the cooked stuff back to be eaten, right?
Uh-huh, yep.
Yep, that raw meat and juices from it could have bacteria in it, which is killed, hopefully, by fully cooking it on the grill, but the bacteria could still be on the platter and the utensils.
So imagine you have raw burgers on a plate, bring them out to the grill, and then when you're done cooking them on the grill, you put them right back on the same plate.
And if the same utensils and plates are not washed or new ones used to bring the cooked meat off the grill, that bacteria goes right back on the food.
That's also a really big goof that you don't want to do.
Now for goof number three, not washing our hands completely before we start food preparation and every time after we've touched any raw meat or poultry and before we touch any other foods, or in fact, Meredith, you say before we touch anything, because you say our hands could have bacteria on them. Our unwashed hands could then contaminate our phones, countertops, spice container, anything. And here's the scary part.
Certain bacteria can live on surfaces for like 72 hours. So think about it. You're making dinner. You've touched chicken, touched your spice containers without washing your hands. And then in the morning, you're cooking eggs and you want to use the same spice in your eggs or something. And then that gets all touched other places. So yeah, it's just crazy what your hands can move around.
So those are the three biggest grilling goofs. There are more. If you have questions about grilling or any food safety subject, use your clean hands to call Meredith or the other experts at the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, or by the numbers, 1-888-674-5463. The experts are on live Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, or you can chat live at ask.usda.gov. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's your news brief for this Friday. We'll be right back.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Senate Republicans held a news conference to outline their counteroffer on overhauling the nation's infrastructure. Senators were led by Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. She is the top Republican on the Environment and Public Works Committee. They are negotiating with President Biden on the scope and cost of an infrastructure bill. Republicans said that they want to spend $928 billion on infrastructure, while President Biden's proposal is $1.7 trillion.
I would like to thank my colleagues, Senator Blunt, Senator Barrasso, Senator Toomey, and they're here with us today. Senator Crapo and Senator Wicker were unable to join, but they're here in spirit. So I'm sorry they're not here, but they have emboldened us to speak in their stead. So where are we? Senate Republicans continue to negotiate in good faith. We've had a lot of good dialogue with the White House. We're trying to get to that common goal of reaching a bipartisan infrastructure agreement that we talked about in the Oval Office with the President several weeks ago, and I talked with him even previous to that. We believe that this counteroffer delivers on what President Biden told us in the Oval Office that day, and that is to try to reach somewhere near $1 trillion over an 8-year period of time that would include our baseline spending. We have achieved that goal with this counteroffer. But we've also, I think, done something that has stayed true to what our beliefs are when we very first started this this endeavor, and that is sticking to the core physical infrastructure, What is the definition of infrastructure? And we have stayed within the boundaries of our original plan. I think that's what the American people think of when they think of infrastructure, and that's certainly what we do too. But there's a couple bits of good news, I think, that have happened since we had that meeting with the president. Number one, we passed a bipartisan water infrastructure package of $35 billion out of my EPW committee center with Chairman Carper, bipartisan. We got an 88 to 2 vote on the Senate floor on that piece of legislation. That's one of the pieces that the president had, and we have a like agreement on in terms of physical infrastructure. The other thing is yesterday, we passed a $316 trillion 5-year surface transportation bill. It has a lot of things that the president wants in there: resiliency, roads and bridges. We have connecting communities in there. And we also have EV charging infrastructure piece in there. So that passed out of our committee 20-0. We are now working on the floor right now, as you all know, on Endless Frontier. Endless Frontier is a bipartisan, came out of Commerce Committee. I'm on Commerce, bipartisan. That was part of what the president initially asked us to look at as infrastructure. We don't consider that physical infrastructure, but we do think it's part of the package that the president should be able to distinguish as part of his infrastructure. So what we are looking at today is a $928 billion package over 8 years. It sticks to the core infrastructure features that we talked to initially. It's a serious effort to try to reach a bipartisan agreement. The president said to me and us in February that he was really agnostic as to whether we pass a bunch of small bills or one large bill. And we've heard him say inaction is not an option for him. We've now passed two of the smaller, and actually the surface transportation hasn't gone out of the full Senate yet, but it is a major anchor to this piece of legislation. And so I think that shows that there's a real hunger for bipartisanship in the United States Senate. There's a real ability to achieve that. And we're hoping that this moves the ball forward. We believe that the alternative, which is a partisan reconciliation process, would be destructive to our future bipartisan attempts, but also doesn't serve the American public and wouldn't get us to an infrastructure package such as the one we believe would serve the American interests, but also constrain spending to the areas of core physical infrastructure that is so important to this country. Our infrastructure has been the envy of the world. We want to see that. We want to take that place again. I personally think we still have it. We just want to make it better. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Toomey.
Thanks very much, Senator Capito, and thanks for your leadership. It's been a lot of hard work, and we're all grateful to you for that. I just want to stress a couple of quick points, and one of them is the consistency with which we have communicated how we think about this to President Biden and his team, and that includes this group of senators. It includes Leader McConnell, and that consistency I'm alluding to is the fact that we want to focus on actual infrastructure, right? The platforms and services that move people and goods and services through our economy. That's what people understand to be infrastructure, and we can reach an agreement if we focus on those items. The second thing that we've been very, very clear on every single time we've had a discussion is that we're not raising taxes. We believe that the 2017 tax reform contributed significantly to enabling us to achieve the best economy of my lifetime. And that's no small thing. And we're not interested in undoing the provisions in the tax reform that allowed us to get there. And then finally, we've also observed that there's a tremendous amount of money that was approved in previous bills, six bills over the course of the last year or so, trillions of dollars, and many hundreds of billions have not even been spent yet. They clearly were not about COVID. They were not about an economic recovery. If you think about it this way, if you look at the offer that we're putting on the table today in spending, which with the 928 figure, and you look at the $355 billion, which is already in the pipeline, expected to come in the form of revenue for the Highway Trust Fund, there's a gap that needs to be filled. That gap call it $575 billion. That's approximately what it is over this 8-year period.
That is our show for today. If you'd like to send me a comment, you can email me, sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Crew, thanks for listening.